Welcome, dear hunters, managers, and enthusiasts. This is Deer University, the podcast of the Mississippi State University Deer Lab. My name is Bronson Strickland.
And I'm Steve Damaris. Bronson and I are professors of wildlife management and co-directors of the MSU Deer Lab. Together, we've researched deer across the United States for more than 40 years. In our podcasts, we explain the why and how of deer management based on science, whether it's research we've conducted or explaining research done elsewhere. We'll offer you a college course in the science of deer management.
But don't let Steve scare you. This isn't going to be a review of calculus or chemistry. Instead, we take results of research, reduce it to what's important, and explain how you can apply research to management. So join us for this episode of Deer University. Welcome back to Deer University. We have to apologize. It has been several weeks since we have been able to record an episode, but for good reason. Myself, as well as Marcus and Steve, we have been traveling all over the country and all over the world recently. And just to let you know, I have been to, where have I been the past month for work? I've been to Michigan, and I just returned from France for a conference over there talking about wild boar and deer. That's where Steve is at as well. He's still there. He'll be back in a few days.
I bet that was a great trip.
It was a great trip.
Yeah.
Climate was...
Talking about a different country, France. No.
We were in the south of France, actually.
Oh, I bet that was beautiful.
Mediterranean environment, low humidity, unlike Mississippi this time of year. That was a lot. It was not good any way at all, but it was interesting to hear Europeans commiserating about wild boar, as they call them. We say wild hogs, wild pigs.
But a problem.
They're having very similar issues over there, and we talked a lot about different control techniques and so forth. And Marcus, you've been out west recently.
Yeah, I was in central Idaho, backpacking in the backcountry and up in the mountains.
Work or pleasure or both?
A little bit of both. We were actually studying elk wallowing behavior, which is pretty cool. You know, we don't have them around here, down here in Mississippi, so it's interesting to see that country, you know, quite different from what it is here. It was also quite nice, you know, low 80s, basically zero humidity. That was pretty refreshing to get away from the Mississippi summer for a little while. So, found several wallows and some pretty cool information about how important elk are to the systems over there. So,
and you presented at a conference.
Over there, in Portland, Oregon. We went from Idaho to Portland, so that was another big change again. But presented some work. It was actually some of the stuff related to the mineral stumps.
Great.
Some of the research associated with that, presenting it to the broader scientific community. So, pretty cool experience.
What did the nerdy scientists think about the mineral stump information?
There was quite a bit of interest, not so much on the mineral stump aspect of it, but on the ecological aspect, you know, about how interesting of a process that is that plants have that response to cutting them down or fire, that sort of thing, and you know, watching it connect several parts of the ecosystem. You know, we're linking plants to a disturbance to other animal species, and that's affecting how the system works. So they're quite fascinated with that sort of thing. So
we're just lucky that deer respond so well.
So we can use it to help us with hunting and understanding land management and that sort of thing, and also has this relevance to the ecological world where we're trying to understand how things work.
How stuff works. That's right. Well, I tell you what, Marcus, we are, it's the end of August already.
Yeah, I can't believe it.
September is this weekend. Mm. I'm going dove hunting, by the way.
Oh, yeah. Saturday. Yeah.
You going?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Plan to.
But that means that food plot time is upon us.
Oh, yeah.
And I'll tell you what, let's start with that. Well, let me back up. So let's talk about food plots today.
Yeah.
First topic, I'm going to tell you what I have always heard, and then what I have come to believe the past 10 years of kind of dabbling, the first couple years dabbling and now doing a lot of food plot research is, of course, I grew up in Georgia, and back then it was Labor Day weekend, dove hunt. It's also time to plant food plots, very beginning of September. And then over there, bow season follows, you know, I don't know if it still does the next weekend or what, but a lot earlier than it does here. And so I had always heard, you know, this is before I became a student and so forth, that planting early like that was just what you did. And the more we have researched this, the more I'm against planting cool season food plots in the beginning of September. And when you look here in Mississippi, which is probably true from a lot throughout the Southeast, the driest month is typically October. And so if you are cutting ground first week of September, putting seed in the ground, then you may have several weeks before you get germination. And during that time, so what's the big deal about that? Well, you could have a lot of seed depredation. Crows, turkeys, small mammals.
Our doves.
Doves.
They will vacuum up seeds. Turkeys also love them.
The other big deal about planting early, and you can't count on this, it's just one of those things that can happen when conditions are right, is let's say you're really, really lucky. You cut ground the beginning of September, put seed in the ground, cover it up, cultipack it, do everything right. You're lucky and you get a timely shower or two. Everything germinates, sprouts, starts growing, and it stays dry, or it stays hot, and then armyworms come through and wipe it completely out. So it has been, I guess I just don't like gambling like some people do. And some people will plant early, and if it fails, then they'll just plant it again. But we're typically, we want to do it, be as strategic as possible, do it one time. And so we typically, you know, around here, we start prepping beginning of October. And it may be mid-October before we put seed in the ground.
I typically, at least, you know, the first week of October, that definitely is the earliest I want to, for the same reasons, you know. And, you know, even if even if you don't have army worms, a plant germinating and trying to get established and then following, you know, maybe you get one little rain shower after you plant, and then you don't get any rain for a month or a month and a half, that really will devastate the plot, because all the seeds that were sitting there germinate, and then they don't have enough water to really get established, and you know, that spells disaster.
It doesn't put them in a good position either to survive or to withstand browsing.
We want them to be able.
Roots have been developed, so to speak.
We want them to be able to take that herbivore pressure. That's what we're planting it for, right?
So here's what a lot of people are going to say, just like I would have said years ago. But I want something green out there when I'm bow hunting. And our response to that is plant something in the warm season and hunt over it during bow season. And you could get, at least, you know, in our climate here, you may be well into November before you have your first frost. And that warm season plant, something like deer vetch, Alice clover, etc., still cranking away.
I think one of the most attractive bow season plots is that late, you know, that summer forage that is really late in its life cycle. The deer vetch in particular, we've just seen amazing things. You know, last year when we had that record drought, we had all these problems we've just talked about. Even though we waited till October, we still didn't get any rain until maybe the end of November. It was really nice having several plots of deer vetch that were still going strong, and deer were just eating them down. Basically a complete failure almost of our cool season, at least until late in the year.
Until December, essentially, when we had sufficient rainfall for it to...
I think it was early January when we got the first biomass measurement.
Cause
we were pairing these things. We're you know, interesting in them from a hunting aspect, but we're also getting data from them. So I think that was the first time we got any data from plots last year from our cool season things, was all the way in the first week of January.
It was.
Unbelievable. That meant early December, there was not enough vegetation there for us to go out and sample it.
Except for the warm season.
Yeah.
Still going strong until that first frost. Well, I know people think we sound like a broken record when we say it's critical to soil tests. I know some people probably roll their eyes, say, "Oh God, don't say that again." But we now have some definitive evidence
Oh, yeah.
of the importance of a soil test. So for those that don't know, this is a, I want to say it's almost free. It's so cheap, but with your state cooperative extension services, as well as there's a lot of third party, I know Mossy Oak for one, and I know a lot of others too, provide that kind of service. But basically, for about seven, eight, certainly less than $10, you can get a soil test and learn what your pH is and what nutrients you need to provide the best environment, growing environment for your plants. So that's a strategy right there. It's just what nutrients do I need to provide for my plants? The other thing is your wallet. There's no point in putting a bunch of phosphorus on the ground if you don't need to add a bunch of phosphorus. And I've certainly had experience with that, to where I mix my own fertilizers and I'm only adding nitrogen, for example, or I may only be adding potassium and I don't need phosphorus. So you
You
can
know,
come
and
out a lot cheaper.
I have planted food plots in a couple of different places now where we had soil tests that we did year after year for 3 or 4 or 5 years, and then we get one back and it says to add nothing. So we literally do not need anything. So you definitely would be wasting your money if you get one of those. And we planted them and they did fantastic, just as well as the other plots that we needed to amend.
That is exactly what you're striving for, to have that after about 3 or 4 years. You can do
And
that.
yeah, you absolutely can have it.
So what we found, that we got to generalize here, Marcus, because we had different forages and different plots, and but what we experimentally proved, air quotes proved,
Have strong evidence for.
very strong evidence, that's well said, that when we looked at our controls, so we planted a clover and we planted a cereal grain, in this case wheat, where we did nothing, just scattered the seed, the right planting rate, the right planting depth. In other words, we did everything right. We just didn't add
Even
any lime or
knowingly,
fertilizer.
right, and we know based on the soil test that we needed it. It was an acidic pH, just like it's going to be very common across most of the landscape.
pH of 5 out there, heavily clay soils.
Deficient in a couple of the nutrients, so.
We did a little randomized design. We had four blocks, so we had a block or a field, and then we randomized four different compartments. One compartment we did nothing but plant the seed. One we only added fertilizer according to the soil test. One we only added lime according to the soil test. And one we followed the soil test explicitly and did lime and fertilizer. And what was the overwhelming result?
Well, I think there were a few different things. I'm not sure which part of it was overwhelming to you, but one thing that really stood out to me was the biomass production of the plants. Especially the clover, the biomass, I believe it was threefold when the soil was amended correctly. So when we applied a lime and fertilizer as needed, we had threefold the biomass of what was produced in the clover that we did not apply that to. So the control plot, and that's a pretty big difference.
With that, it was kind of, we didn't know this going in, so this was unbeknownst to us at the time, but by not adding anything, even just even the survival, if you remember those clover
Oh
plots,
yeah,
it was
they were
very, very
sparse.
patchy. It wasn't just that the clover got established but didn't grow very well. It didn't even get established.
Yeah, and you remember we just got through talking about drought, and one thing that was particularly interesting, I remember when we were standing there together looking at it, is the plots that we amended the soil according to soil test withstood the drought conditions much better.
Yeah, that's
So
right.
the not only did we have poor seedling survival in the control, but the drought made that even worse. Because I assume it's because the plants were better able to establish a root system
Yeah, more root biomass.
to take advantage of the little bit of water that was in the soil. So It was sort of a interesting experience and eye-opening for me that it's not, the biomass was the threefold. That's pretty incredible. But also, the plants were just healthier. They were able to deal with that stress. Probably were dealing with deer herbivory much easier as well, because the plant is healthy. And when we looked in the plant, do you remember? Like when we actually look at the nutritional quality of the plant, that healthier plant actually changed in nutritional quality.
It wasn't overwhelming across the board, but there were certainly a few that and we did this in the warm season and the cool season. And if I remember correctly, so what we're going to have to do, we're saying all this based on memory, Marcus. When we get this published, we'll have to revisit this and put it on our website with the
Some
exact
data.
results. But I do remember this vividly because I remember looking at the chart being overwhelmed. For one of the warm season forages, lime outperformed fertilizer. So lime and fertilizer was the best, but second best was just lime with no fertilizer. Now we saw just the opposite of that with the cool season stuff. Lime and fertilizer clearly the best, fertilizer number two, lime number three, and then of course a distant fourth place was the control
Yeah, it was
with nothing.
definitely way behind. So not only do we get more biomass, but the quality of the plant is also better. And again, we're going based on memory, but we were monitoring deer use of these things, not just with the cage in it. We actually were monitoring it with cameras. And the best I recall, we were getting quite a bit more traffic in the ones that we limed and fertilized.
Well, also, first fruits from our experiment with our graduate student Jacob Dykes, in some of the trials, we think one of the biggest indicators for drawing a deer, if they come out into a food plot, am I going to go left, right, or straight, was the visual cue of biomass.
Yeah, it looked like they could see, oh, there's the good place to eat right over there.
My goodness, that clover's knee high over there. I'm going to
And
go.
we, but a lot of our listeners have probably seen this. You go out into your food plot and it looks yellow. Like maybe you didn't amend your soils this year, you had something go wrong or whatever, and you can see that the plants are stressed. They walk out there and see this luscious green, enormous biomass of stuff. Of course, they're going to go over there and eat that good-looking salad. You're not going to eat the brown salad. You're going to go over there and eat the good green stuff.
Without a doubt. Let's talk for a second too, Marcus, and we're going to test this fall, and we try to do this. Not last year, but the year before, and we had another dang drought, if you remember that, and
Oh,
messed it
yeah.
up. But
Seems like something every year. It's something different every
it
time, too, it
is
seems
something
like.
every year.
Which is another reason that these cool seasons forages is pretty important to have that warm season to fall back on if you have to.
You
Because,
always have the buffer.
yeah, we end up with the one time it was too wet. I don't remember if you remember that one.
Yeah, I remember.
We couldn't ever, we had plenty of water, and so much so, we couldn't ever get the tractor out there to put any seeds in the ground. It was just too wet.
I do remember. It's one or the other. Let's talk about planting rate real quick. So let's give the our standard wildlife biologist response, and then maybe let's talk a little bit about some stuff we've been thinking about, some stuff we want to test that at least has intuitive appeal to us, and then when we find this answer out, we'll come back and deliver an episode on it. So what we always say, I know I've said it because I've read it, people I trust, I believe, is that don't ever plant more than what the label says. And so you're just throwing money away. You're gonna create, if you put out double the planting rate, you're gonna end up with a lot of competition. And so you might have a bunch of stunted plants rather than having, half of the crop, the plant population,
They're all performing well.
but they're performing well, they're flourishing. And so, it's like, why would you spend double the money when you don't have to? Now, the one thing we've talked about, and we may be wrong,
Yeah,
but
we don't know. It's a hypothesis.
we at least, we think, we're pretty sure about this, that a lot of these planting rates establish for every one of these agronomic plants is typically based on the assumptions. So let's take wheat, for example.
Yeah, great example.
Wheat was not really developed to be a food plant. It's an agronomic big ag plant. And when they establish a planting rate, it is based on not the forage biomass produced, it's based on the grain.
Yeah, you maximize grain production.
Yeah, what's the optimal population, what's the optimal spacing such that you will get the greatest yield of grain?
I think maybe most importantly, it's not, you know, even if it was to maximize biomass, it's making a key assumption, and that is that it's not having to deal with chronic herbivory.
So
in other words, deer aren't just eating it down to the ground constantly, which is kind of our intention when we're using it in a food plot.
Yeah.
You don't want them to obviously create a dirt hole where they've killed all the plants in there, but we do want them to eat it.
Yeah, we want at least half of that biomass intent, cropped off at all times.
Our intent really isn't to maximize biomass. It's to maximize the biomass delivered to our deer.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a little bit different.
Yeah. So with that important caveat, it very well may be that we need to increase the planting rate.
Yeah, it could be. You know, when a plant is trying to perform at an optimal level, competition between plants becomes pretty important, especially for something like seed production. So the density of plants, or in other words, how many seeds you put on the ground, makes a big difference. But the other thing that makes a big difference to that plant is being predated.
Mm-hmm.
So a deer is a predator to a plant.
Yep.
Okay. So that is also a big stress on that plant. And, you know, when you have that chronic herbivory, the stocking rate may change based on which one of those things are the stressor.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, is it stress by competing with the other plants? Or is it stress because you have an herbivore eating you all the time?
Right.
So the stocking rate is not necessarily the same. And just to give you an example of how that might change, if deer come in and start nipping off plants and you end up sort of weeding those plants out, so the ones that don't deal with the herbivory very well start dying, you know, that higher seeding rate could actually yield more biomass to the deer at that point, because some of them we know are going to die from the herbivory, or not be able to, you know, they won't be as competitive at least.
Yeah.
So that, you know, the competition between plants could definitely be altered by the herbivore and the, you know, the herbivore we're intentionally trying to get to eat in it.
Yeah.
You know, if you're an agricultural producer, you were trying to avoid that.
Yeah, that's not your motivation.
Yeah. And the seed rate was developed based on that. You know, we're planting giant fields where deer aren't grazing all of it down to the ground. By intent.
For a combine to come through in April or May and collect the seed head off
of it. And, you know, I've talked to my father about this several times because, you know, there have been some instances where we plowed a little more seed than I would have recommended. And, you know, we talked back and forth about it. And, you know, in his experience, and I can't argue with it, he applies more seed than the label, and he may be very well be right, because we get a lot of deer pressure on them and the food plots look fantastic every year, year after year. And you can't argue with it.
Yeah.
So what we want to do is go back to that. And we have this new hypothesis that we're thinking about, that in the case where you have an herbivore that is by intent a stress on it, it may actually change that seeding rate that we should be recommending.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what we're going to do.
Yeah.
So we're going to go through and do half the amount, maybe three quarters of the amount, the exact prescribed amount, 1.5, double, and then we're going to look in the presence. That's the difference here. In the presence of heavy deer browsing.
Yeah. We're actually going to do both. So we're going to have all of those different treatments. Our treatment in this case is going to be the seeding rate of a, you know, particular plant species. So you look at the half, the full rate based on the label, maybe double that rate, whatever. But also, we're going to have some exclosures there, so we'll have some plots that don't have deer, in other words. So we're actually looking at that seeding rate and how it affects biomass production of the plants with and without that herbivore, which really lets us get strong evidence for one thing or another.
So it's completely possible that inside of that cage where herbivory has been excluded, we may either find no difference, or we may find that biomass may even be greater for the exact prescribed seeding rate than double the seeding rate.
Yeah, I think that's one hypothesis.
But outside the cage...
Yeah, inside the cage, the plant-to-plant competition should be more important because there isn't an herbivore, which is the way the seed, you know, that rate was developed. So I fully expect that we could see that, and I would predict outside it's going to change just because we have a different stressor that may rank supreme. Mm-hmm.
Well, let me put you on the spot here. And if you don't know, we can always cut it out.
Okay.
So, you know, I'm going back to your information about mineral stumps and above ground and below ground biomass, matching those up. So is it reasonable to assume that with something like wheat or a cereal grain or whatever plant, but something like a cereal grain will tolerate, obviously, because it's a grass, it'll tolerate a lot of browsing. If you start removing constantly a lot of the above-ground biomass, therefore it does not have a lot of tissue to photosynthesize, that will also limit the growth of below-ground biomass? In other words, root biomass?
The plant... So the plant starts establishing that root biomass, and then if you continually remove the above-ground biomass, it does start mobilizing those nutrients into the above-ground tissue, and it essentially is sort of dwindling its resources in its root system. So you could see that. I'm trying to think of the research related to this. There are a couple of different lines of research that have looked at this. In some cases, the plant starts dealing with it by actually investing more into root system production rather than shoot production. So it could actually develop a bigger root system. Some plant species might do that. One thing that probably also will happen is if they're continually cropping that grass off, I mean, you think about that mineral stump idea, you know, we've altered that root to shoot ratio, and the quality of the vegetation that responds to that is much higher. We've shown that same thing in some grasslands, and some of the folks that are familiar with cattle operations may know about this. If you have that herbivore continuously cropping that vegetation back, the responding growth is actually higher quality. So you could actually end up with that same sort of thing going on in your food plot. As the plants respond to the herbivore, they're actually higher quality, not only because it's new growth, but the new growth itself may also be a little bit higher quality. Of course, over time, it eventually exhausts all its resources. And probably in this case, that grass, it would exhaust those resources over a quicker amount of time than a tree that has a large extensive root system. So you could have several things going on depending on what the plant species is and, you know, the adaptations of that plant. You know, we've manipulated these plants by breeding them to get certain characteristics out of them. Some of them actually, you know, we actually have some food plot formulations that have plants that have been specifically bred to deal with herbivory. So, you know, those kinds of things are out there, and you might end up with different responses depending on what you're looking at.
So here's one thing I remember. I'm not trying to win an argument here, okay? I'm just trying I've got
fodder.
A pet hypothesis here. I'm trying to... So I see a lot where that comes across my desk, you know, for different forages for cattle. And they might say, you know, alfalfa or whatever, you know, Bermuda grass or Bahia grass. And they'll give, you know, the seeding rate, here's the optimal planting date. And then there's usually a caveat, but don't graze it until X. You need to give it X amount of time for it to get completely established. But as soon as our stuff comes out of the ground, it's getting browsed. So I still wonder if And this is all going back to maybe we need a greater seeding rate. It's because we're not going to have a lot of plant competition.
Yeah.
And nor are we going to have a big root time for the roots to get developed, because they're continually being cropped right when they come out of the ground.
Yeah. So. Yeah, they don't really have time to get established. The deer are on them immediately.
Now, Marcus, I just remembered something when I said cereal grains like wheat are a grass. So a comment that we got for clarification on an email was, you guys are always talking about how deer eat forbs and browse. They don't eat grass.
Mm-hmm.
But now we're sitting here saying that wheat and oats and rye, etc., is a grass.
Mm-hmm.
You want to tackle that one?
That's a good comment and question. And so the thing that I experience most often with landowners or hunters, you know, when they're thinking about an herbivore, they're thinking about a cow. And a cow's a grazer. So basically it's on the extreme end of the herbivory spectrum where they are primarily eating grass as a huge part of their diet. Deer are on the opposite end of that spectrum. And they are primarily eating, for the most part of the year, the major source of vegetation in their diet is broadleaf plants. So that'd be forbs, browse, you know, those things are overwhelmingly most dominant in the diet.
Yeah.
Now, we commonly say they won't eat grass, and for a large portion of the year, they don't eat much grass. In fact, it almost doesn't show up in their diet in some seasons, especially during the summer. They'll eat bark off of a tree. They'll eat dirt. You know, they have to eat something to keep cycling. So they will eat grass, even in those times if they are forced to. But when we get around to the cool season, the amount of grass in their diet actually does increase. So you think about on the landscape, there's not as much stuff to eat, especially broadleaf plants. So they do shift a little bit naturally, even if there weren't any food plots planted. And you'll see a little bit more of our native grasses in their diet. But another thing to keep in mind, like with wheat and oats and, you know, these cereal grains, they are grasses, but, you know, they're annual grasses, and they actually, from a nutritional standpoint, are pretty close to a lot of the forbs they may be eating in terms of quality. They don't have that much lignin in them. And, you know, we do see them readily eat those things. So it's sort of a combination of things that we're seeing. One, we're in a different season where grass is a little more of their diet naturally. Two, we have a grass that's probably more similar to our native forbs than it would be to our native grasses. So my main point is they're not cows. They don't depend on grass. And in fact, for a large portion of the year, they would even avoid eating grass unless they really need to. But during the time we plant these food plots and the specific species that we plant in the food plot, they absolutely love those. So they readily eat grass, but only some specific times of the year with some specific forages do they, you know, select to eat it as a large portion of their diet anyway.
And I agree 100%. I guess so
they're browsers. And that basically means that they eat broadleaf plants primarily. And that's definitely over 80% of their diet on a year-round basis. So,
what I would add, and what I typically how I try to answer that is, even though the wheat, the oats, etc., are classified as a grass, so technically it is a grass.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not your typical natural grass.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So it is classified as a grass, but it's an agronomic grass.
Right.
And it's not grown to be a grass. It's grown to be a grain producer.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you go out and just disturb the soil, the native grasses that would grow, or the pasture grasses, if you planted them.
Especially improved pasture grasses.
Yeah, deer aren't going to eat that.
It's terrible.
So I guess when you think about what, you know, when I identify wheat as a grass, I really don't think of wheat as a grass per se, like Johnson grass, Bahia grass, stuff like that. Bermuda grass.
Yeah, that's and if you actually start looking at the nutritional quality of all those different ones you just named, the wheat sort of stands alone.
Yeah.
That from a quality standpoint, for a browser, the wheat is much closer to the browser's diet, and those other grasses are, you know, for a grazer, are much, you know, a cow has a lot more foraging bouts, so you'll notice they feed a lot more time of the day, and they have a longer digestive tract, so they, you know, everything that they have is designed to be able to extract nutrients out of a relatively poor quality forage,
mm-hmm.
which is the grass. Whereas the deer are extremely selective, so they're not only selecting plant species, but also particular parts of those plants. They're really trying to navigate the environment and pick only the good things to eat, rather than a grazer like a cow that on that spectrum, they're relatively non-selective.
Yeah.
So, you know, if they're in a pasture, all the grass is pretty much the same quality. It's all bad.
Just cram it in.
Let's just eat as much of it as possible and keep it in there for a long time to extract as much of the nutrients as possible efficiently. The deer has a much quicker cycle, and its strategy is different. It's trying to select the highest quality parts of the highest quality plants.
A deer's rumen is also smaller relative to its body size.
Yeah.
Or you can say a cow's is relatively bigger
mm-hmm.
to deal with all that roughage.
Yeah, so that, you know, that all these different animals and plants have their own sets of adaptations, and those two, you know, we commonly think of them as being the same thing, and you know, they're actually, in terms of an herbivore, on opposite ends of the spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
So
that's right.
That's a great question. Something we talk about constantly is, you know, we're really familiar with cows, but deer aren't cows.
Yeah. It really is a good question.
Yeah.
Somebody's really listening when we say deer don't eat grass, and wait a minute.
Yeah, it's a great discussion point, and you know, something that we talk about constantly with people, because they're like, wait, you just got through saying they don't eat grass,
yourself.
And then you're telling us to plant a cereal
plant grass.
Grain grass.
Okay, so there's going to be some people sitting back going, all right, that's enough of that jibber-jabber.
Yeah.
What do we plant? So I'll start, I'll give my very generic response of, you can fill in the blank here with a lot of different species, but basically I want a cereal grain to pop right out of the ground mm-hmm. within 1 week after I planted it, or sooner, mm-hmm. assuming you have moisture. It's not a necessity, but I kind of like having a brassica, but something like a rape.
Mm-hmm.
Dwarf Essex rape is one we use around here a lot. And I always want a clover
mm-hmm.
because I'm interested not only in having a palatable food plot to increase deer observation and hunting opportunity, I want to add nutrition.
Mm-hmm.
And the combination of a cereal grain as well as a brassica, which you can or cannot, that's up to you to include that or not, and then wrapping that up with a clover, you are going to get close to 6 months of deer
mm-hmm.
forage. If it's limed and fertilized correctly, and maybe even with herbicides, if you have to control some type of weed, you can do that. Now, the thing about it is, you can tweak some of those and stretch it out to 9 or 10 months,
mm-hmm.
but it may be a little bit more expensive.
Oh, yeah. But sometimes, you know, depending on your objectives, it may be worth that extra expense.
Oh, yeah. For me, it is.
Yeah.
It's because it's about nutrition for me. So I really think, I'll get you to comment on this, Marcus, if you had to choose, let's say that they cost the same thing. Let's
mm-hmm.
say these three cereal grains cost the same. Oats, wheat, rye. Not rye grass, rye. Elban rye is a real popular one.
Mm-hmm.
What's your favorite?
I'd probably pick wheat if I was just going to plant one thing, and that's because what you were talking about, and the reason you would have those different plants is because of the phenology of the biomass production, really. So what we're talking about is the timing that it's peaking in biomass, and the wheat is sort of in the middle,
mm-hmm.
so it's not as early as oats. Oats, you know, they get out of the ground really quick and hit the ground running, and they peak pretty quick early in the hunting season. And the wheat is a little bit behind them, maybe a month behind, and then the rye's a little bit behind it. And in terms of, you know, your peak in production hitting the center of your hunting season, wheat generally is the one that does that best in most places. So that's the one I would pick.
If you had to pick one.
Yeah, but if you were only picking one, that's my knee-jerk reaction, is wheat sort of, you know, hitting the middle of your hunting season with it.
Mm-hmm. I had always favored oats for it getting out of the ground quick.
Mm-hmm.
And it depends on where you're at in the South or the Mid-South or the Midwest. If you got a real mild winter like you do down here, it may be January before you have some of those cold temperatures to really stop oats from growing.
Yeah.
But you know what? You're really splitting hairs, in my opinion, with a lot of this. They're all good.
Oats, that one, if I had a place that I'm going to primarily bow hunt, I would jump on that one.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm just, you know, thinking about like an Alabama or Mississippi or, you know, some of these southern states that have a really long deer season. You're trying to get things up early for your bow season potentially. Oats is a good option for that front end, but in my experience, the wheat is a all-around better plant in terms of centering that biomass production in the center of the season. But you're right, the oats can keep going, and especially, you know, we talked about that cropping of the deer, they're cropping that plant back, so it's sort of slowing down that succession on the plant. So you may get an extended effect from that. But you're right. Yeah, we're splitting hairs now.
Yeah.
All three of those cereal grains are excellent.
And I handicapped you a moment ago because I said if they're all priced the same.
Yeah.
Now, in reality, wheat's going to be the cheapest.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, in terms of bang for your buck, normally wheat is the way to go.
Now, neither one of us mentioned rye. You for it or against it or just a little indifferent?
So the cereal rye?
Yeah.
I love that plant. There's nothing wrong with it.
Okay.
It typically, it seems like in the South, at least to me, that it doesn't perform quite as well. But we tend to see a little more use from the deer, like in terms of what they like to eat, especially later in the season. It seems like they like it a little better.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a fantastic plant. There's nothing wrong with it. You've forced my hand.
Well,
and I was just picking the winner of the who can produce the most in the middle of the season.
Yeah, certainly.
Yeah.
And we certainly saw that with Jacob's experiment. We saw a lot of selection towards rye.
Yeah,
so.
Especially later in the hunting season.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed to be a little better in terms of what deer like later in the season.
So let's talk about now what are your favorite clovers, and I'll start with, one you just can't go wrong. I think you can tweak it and maybe do a little bit better, but it's kind of like wheat where you just can't go wrong with crimson clover.
Yeah.
I mean, it is so affordable.
Mm-hmm.
It germinates so easy. It's not a picky plant. You know, it'll grow.
It produces a lot of biomass.
That's right.
Yep.
One I like in the fall, and let me qualify this by saying on our soils with our rainfall regimes, our temperatures, et cetera, et cetera. But when we plant Berseem clover, before it gets cold, what I have seen is that one produces more biomass than any of the other clovers.
Yeah.
So it gets out of the ground and produces a bunch of above-ground biomass more than any of the ones we've tested and I've seen.
Sure.
And then when it gets really, really cold, it's probably going to be average.
Yeah.
And then when it warms back up in springtime, it picks right back up. Another one we have seen perform really, really well in the springtime is Blansa.
Mm-hmm.
Blansa clover isn't really common, but man, when it gets to be April and May... I call it, my joke is I call it kudzu clover
because
it grows like kudzu everywhere.
Yeah, just jumps up.
Mm-hmm.
Deer like it.
Deer love it. It's also a reseeder. It's not a perennial plant, but man, it produces a tremendous amount of seed.
And the crimson also, you can get that reseeding crimson, and both of them can be kept going. I've seen it happen for years and years and years.
And then if we really want to extend deer foraging into summertime, you need to add another clover. Well, there's two of them, but one of them in particular, red clover.
Yeah, the red clover, you're exactly right. If you're wanting to extend that high-quality forage production on into the warm months, that's a necessary addition.
When all the others have literally wilted and look like you've sprayed them with Roundup, that red clover is still cranking away.
I noticed this year, you'll ride down the road and you'll see crimson, on the sides of the highway. You'll see it blooming, and it, it's really pretty and luscious and looking great. And then you get around to mid-May, something like that, and it starts, dying off and going away. And I noticed this year in particular, about mid-June, all of a sudden there's all that red clover. And it was all up and down the side of the road. I paid close attention to that. I was seeing exactly what you're saying. It was still looking good.
And let's remind people, because it's completely counterintuitive.
Yeah.
The clover with the pink bloom is a red clover.
Yeah.
The clover with the dark red bloom is crimson clover.
Yeah. The dark red, I guess it is more like a crimson color, but it doesn't. It's not intuitive that the red clover would actually be pink.
Be pink.
And it's light. Yeah. It's not even a dark pink. It's really light pink.
Yeah. It's a pastel pink.
Yeah. It's a really pretty color.
So those are kind of some of. Those are my favorite. Now here's some other ones too that arrowleaf clover is planted a lot.
Yeah, I like
and
it a lot.
Great plant. We've got some colleagues too that really that's all they plant. They loved to do a crimson clover and add arrowleaf. The problem that I have seen with arrowleaf, again, just my experience. So somebody else may have had a completely different experience. Is to me, it doesn't put out the same amount of forage that some of the others do, like red.
Yeah, it gets really woody. It looks really good if you just look at the biomass of it, but if you actually look at, it's kind of stemmy.
Very stemmy.
And a lot of that biomass probably doesn't get used because it's just getting a little bit too lignified.
Mm-hmm.
The parts of it that deer can use are really high quality.
Yeah.
But a lot of the biomass often isn't high quality. So, it sort of inflates that biomass production to me. In terms of what deer are actually eating out of it.
Because you can look at you can grab a plant, an arrowleaf plant, and it may be 3 foot tall or more, but there will only be four or five little trifoliate leaves on there, if you've noticed. So you might have
especially later
6 inches of stem before you have another leaf.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's the only knock on that.
It's still a great plant.
And if you tolerates heat.
Yeah, and if you have a lot of deer eating on it, it doesn't, it suppresses it from getting so stemmy.
Yeah.
So.
Well.
One other thing I always like to think about and bring up and get people to think critically about, we've talked about it a little bit on some of the other podcasts, I think, and some people get mad about it because we love, as biologists, to say it depends.
Mm-hmm.
And that dreaded word, people seem to, they want a straight answer, clear cut and dry. What do I plant? This, is this thing right or is that thing right? And one thing I like to bring up on this particular topic, people ask me all the time, what do I plant in my food plot? And the answer is that it depends. It depends on a lot of things. One is, what is your objectives? Two, the thing that people think less about is, deer, we've just talked about throughout this podcast, deer are really selective of different plants and different parts of those plants, and that selection changes based on what that deer needs. So it's hard for me to tell you on this property what to plant and then someone 10 miles down the road what to plant when I don't really know what's limiting to those two deer herds. It may not be the same thing.
Yeah.
And this is a classic debate between, cousins or brothers or, you know, friends or whatever, and one of them's what you know, stand by and, you know, oh man, this is the greatest thing to plant, you should plant it, and then your buddy down the road's like, nope, this plant ranks supreme, and in reality you may both be right.
Yeah. Yep.
You know, if your deer herd have different stressors, and they inevitably probably do, it could change which plants are best based on the nutritional needs of the deer herd, how many deer there are, how you're managing the surrounding forest.
Native vegetation, right, composition, what nutrients are available,
yeah,
what are available in the soil.
Yeah, all those things can alter what the deer actually need, which will manifest in how they eat those different plants. You may also see something similar based on what kind of soil type you're in. There may be one plant that performs better in it than another. So you could actually get, it could be driven by the deer's needs or by the plant's needs,
mm-hmm.
and you could see different performance between some of these plants. One of the bottom line is, you know, most of these forages are good all around plants, and they're great forages, and, you know, don't be afraid to tweak it a little bit and sort of test what things work on your own property, because they're all great plants, all of those ones we're talking about, and what works on one property may not necessarily be the best thing on the next one. There's not a silver bullet, and keep that in mind when you're arguing with your buddy.
Yeah,
that this plant's better than that one. It may be on your property, but it may not be on his.
Yeah. And that's the way we're hardwired. You know, we're kind of living, breathing Mythbusters. I'm going to split that plot up four ways, and let's test it. Let's put that seed over there, that seed over there, put a cage around it, and let's watch it.
Yeah. All you got to do is sit in your deer stand. But maybe you and your buddy are on a lease together, and you're arguing over which plant's best. Why don't you plant half the plot in both of them one year, and you'll sit in the deer stand and see which one they select. Then maybe next year you flip it, just for good measure, and let's see which side they use.
Good
that
experimental
year.
Design there, Marcus. You got to flip it.
Because, you know, it may be driven because they like to come out one corner or something like that.
Got
so,
yep.
I always think about it as a scientist like that, but most people don't consider that, you know, not every deer on the landscape has the same needs, which could drive what's best for them in terms of supplementation with these food plot mixes.
Yeah. I would add one more thing, Marcus, and this is a little bit more theoretical, but it's certainly true with livestock, and it's got to be going on with deer, and that is experience.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of what mom ate, what mom exposed me to, and, you know, every animal, even us as humans, there's a little bit of trepidation with a novel food.
Yeah.
Go to France, for example. And then put something on your plate, and you don't know what it is, and you sniff it, and you look at it, and you taste a little bit. And that's the way some of these are. And, you know, there's one cool season plant. I hear this all the time, and there's one warm season plant. I hear it all the time. Cool season, my buddy plants turnips and radishes, and they tear it up on his property, and they don't touch it on mine.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of different things that could be. All the things you talked about, some kind of soil interaction, it doesn't grow well, and because it doesn't grow well, maybe it doesn't taste well. Or the deer, it's novel. They're not used to it yet.
Yeah, they may not know what it is.
Yeah.
They don't know it as a food.
And then after one of them, eventually they get going, and then they expect it, and they're used to it. And the other one's cowpeas. Compared to soybeans or something. You plant soybeans, deer are going to eat it. Cowpeas, it may take them a while to get used to it.
I got to experience that in Tennessee when I planted soybeans and cowpeas directly next to each other, and I watched them defoliate the soybeans and not eat any of the cowpeas.
Mm-hmm.
And I have also, in the same county, planted cowpeas and watched them annihilate the cowpea.
I have too.
So you're absolutely right. And some of that could be experience. You know, what did mom eat? Experience of the individual, maybe over time it takes a few bites of those cowpeas and it learns, hey, this is pretty good. I'll go ahead and eat that. Another one that I've experienced this with to a less degree because I haven't planted it as much, but I have seen this happen with Lab. I've planted it in some places and they just won't touch it, and other places they seem to eat it pretty good. So one thing we can't debate is whether or not it's a high quality plant. It does deliver a lot of nutrients if they're eating it. All of these that we're talking about do. So you have to, you know, some of this is customizable at the property level.
Yeah.
You know, you got to keep in mind all these things are good, and you have different trade-offs that you're making based on cost and what grows well and what your deer really like or need.
So that's a really, really good point, Marcus. We need to emphasize that they're all good.
Yeah.
They're all good. They're all palatable to some degree. They all have nutrients, a lot of nutrients. They all grow well, depending on your soils, your rainfall pattern, etc., etc. So, like what you're saying, your experience with LabLab, I sat here earlier on the episode and said, you know, I really like some of these brassicas, but I could take it or leave it. And maybe that's just because on the soils where I've been planting them, I don't get brassicas knee high.
Yeah.
And maybe these old clay soils that are wet and it just doesn't grow very well.
Yeah, my experience with them is the same. I in most cases do not see them eat them very well. But I have numerous people that will argue up and down that that's the best thing that ever happened to a
Well,
deer.
they'll send us photographs.
Oh
You
yeah,
know,
they're just
the
tearing them up.
brassicas are almost knee high and then bam, the deer hit them and I mean, tear them up. So I guess all that to say is try them on your property. None of these plants are inherently one's better than the other.
Yeah. I mean, we have the, you know, we sort of outline some that are tried and true,
Yeah.
and that one of the reasons they're tried and true is because they're widely adaptable and they, you know, they perform well in a lot of different scenarios, and deer seem to use them pretty well across a lot of areas. But that is not to say that some of those other ones aren't as good. It's just those are, you know, those are the tried and true. More than likely, they're going to do well wherever you're
On the
at.
average across the board, they're a safe bet.
Yeah.
So why don't we amend that or add on to that and say there's really not one of these plants that's really, really better than the other, but there may be some of these plants that are really, really better on your property.
Yeah,
And
on
so
your
it's your job
property.
to experiment and figure out what those are.
Yeah, one thing absolutely could be superior on your property over the other ones just because of the things we've talked about.
Well, Marcus, let's wrap up with let's don't get into a heated debate, but you and I have both had heated debates with other people about this one particular plant.
I knew we couldn't get through it without
Well, we got to, or somebody would ask us. Ryegrass.
Yep.
And I honestly have no idea how far north the prevalence of ryegrass goes,
It
but
seems to be a deep south to mid south thing.
so certainly from Tennessee south,
Yeah,
there's
maybe
all
even into Kentucky, but
into Kentucky. Okay. So there's a lot of people, I mean a lot of people in Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, et cetera, that swear by it. And let's talk about some of the good things about ryegrass. Number one, sprinkle it in the back of your truck bed and get some moisture on top of it. And it will germinate,
Yeah.
and you will have a stand of ryegrass in your truck bed.
Yeah, or you can throw it on the roof.
Yeah, in your
Yeah, that's
driveway.
yeah. And you actually see it as a sort of a filler in a lot of different scenarios, whether it be a bag of food plot seed or a, you know, something for your yard or whatever. And that's one of the reasons because, man, that thing will grow anywhere. It can tolerate a huge range of conditions.
If there's any plant that you can quote guarantee a green field,
Yeah.
it will be ryegrass.
Yeah, it's going to
It's
grow, and
tough
it you can
stuff.
even plant it in the wrong season, and it might, you know,
Yeah.
still performs.
And deer will eat it.
Yeah, there's
They'll
no
eat the
question
heck out
about
of
that.
it.
Yep.
I don't like it because I think there's a lot of collateral damage
Oh, yeah.
associated. There's baggage that comes with ryegrass. So I have absolutely zero doubt that I can go out to some of our test plots and I can spread ryegrass. I can amend the soil. I can fertilize it very well, and deer are going to eat the snot out of it.
Yep, no question they
But
will.
now I got to deal with it forever
Yeah.
and ever and ever until I hit it with herbicides.
Yep, and even then, you're going to work on it. You're going to have to work to get rid of it. So you're exactly right. That's one major baggage that it comes with is once you have it, you got it. And if you inherit that land from somebody else, or you buy a piece of property and they ever planted ryegrass, or maybe they you had some roads put in and they seeded the sides of those roads, I mean, it's there.
It's there.
Yeah.
And when ryegrass, even though deer will certainly eat it, come November, December, January, February, et cetera, when that stuff goes to seed and becomes really lignified, in other words, when it turns that golden brown, deer are not going to eat it.
Yeah, they
and you have a stand of seed.
Yeah, and it really suppresses anything else that was with it at that point.
And people that can, they can go on our Deer Lab Facebook page. I know I've posted over the years a lot. You can dig back and look at some of that. So we had some test plots, Marcus. This is probably before you came or right when you were coming, that of course we had never planted ryegrass.
Yeah.
And when we got this property, somebody maybe even 3 years prior. But if I remember correctly, it had been 5 years minimum to when somebody planted ryegrass. And I go out there to look at this beautiful stand of crimson clover or balanza clover or and it was completely eaten up with ryegrass. Even though we had never planted it.
We actually, a couple of the same plots, I think, because I think that was right when I was getting here, a couple of the same plots we've treated 2 or 3 years in a row now, trying to get rid of it, and then planted something this year, and we still had it.
Yeah. And we're doing all the right things, spraying it at the right time of year. We're doing everything you're supposed to.
Yeah, we're doing it by the book. It's just, it's one of those plants that'll grow on your roof.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's, so that's a good thing about it in some scenarios, but it's also a problem when you're trying to get rid of it, if you ever do want to get rid of it. So another thing that most people don't think about, and I think it's interesting, I've pointed it out a few different times, you know, you go and diss that plot and maybe you didn't quite get it seeded before you wanted to because it rained. You know, you got that rain that you needed, but it was right before you applied the seed, and you come back a week later when it's finally dry enough and you got grass popping up everywhere. And you look out and it's like, oh man, look at all these weeds coming in. That's ryegrass.
Yeah.
So you're going to
seed it again.
We're going to disc up the ryegrass and then plant ryegrass.
Yeah. Go pay for more ryegrass and plant more ryegrass.
So if you're going to, you know, once you plant it one time, pretty good chance you're going to have it. So, if you, you know, why plant it again? You know, if that was what you were going to do with it, then,
yeah,
I've seen it time and time again where it just, you know, it's the weed that comes up.
I've never seen, okay, so think of it like this. If you could plant ryegrass and the deer loved it so much that they kept it suppressed where it never went to seed and then it got too hot and it died, it wouldn't be that big of a problem.
Yeah.
Have you ever seen that in your life?
I have never not seen it be able to go to seed.
That's right.
You know what I have seen that happen to, though? Just about everything else we've talked about.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So that tells you right there. So you can have a dense stand of ryegrass, and
when they again, they will eat it. Mm-hmm. And if you're planting ryegrass, you might ought to go disc it and let it rain on it one time before you plant some again and see if you get ryegrass back. Because if you are going to go with ryegrass, you probably don't need to plant it over and over.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and then let's be fair here. Let's say I've got my property or a hunting lease or whatever, and I am only concerned about seeing deer. Either I'm not interested in deer nutrition and improving diet quality, or let's just say, heck, diet quality is already good enough. That is probably the cheapest thing you could do.
Oh yeah.
Is get ryegrass established and then just fertilize it every fall. And you will have a green field that deer use.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I'm interested in nutrition. You're interested in nutrition.
Well,
most people are.
Know,
I don't want to suppress clover in the springtime with ryegrass.
Yeah, and you know, in our experience, it's just they don't like it as much as all those other things we were talking about. In most places, you just don't. I mean, they use it, especially if it's the only thing green around. But what if your neighbor planted something that was really awesome? You know, that they like a lot more. Where's the deer going to go?
Yeah, that good old wheat crimson.
You ever heard that problem? Oh, our neighbors shoot everything. Well, they may be planting something better than you. It's maybe one of the problems.
And gosh, I thought we were going to wrap up on ryegrass, Marcus. I just remembered something too. We hadn't talked about white clover.
Oh, yeah.
White clover.
We didn't even talk about it. How did we do
Yeah,
that?
I don't know. We missed it. We got to yakking and talking about other stuff. So, a quick review: white clover is a perennial clover. All the others we spoke about are annual clovers, except for red. And red is one of those where it's not perennial forever and ever, amen. It usually in the South has a 2 to 3 year
Biennial.
duration, unless it reseeds. And that's the thing about a lot of these annual clovers is that if you let them go to seed, and the deer let them go to seed, then you'll have them the next year. White clover is a perennial clover. If you plant it in the fall, typically with what we call a nurse plant or something to go with it, like a cereal grain, wheat is really common. And you fertilize it correctly, and you keep the weeds under control, and that's key, is you got to keep the weeds under control. You will have it, you can have it forever. Certainly 10 years. Now, a lot of people, 10 years down the road, there might have been, we had a really bad drought this year, or it got really wet at this part of the field, but year in, year out, you've got white clover.
Yeah, you're right. You can keep it going. I've seen it going for, years and years, and it's a fantastic forage. The production on it does not equate to that of the annual plants you would plant in your cool season or warm season. You don't get as much biomass out of it, but it is a good thing to have on the landscape because it sort of connects the gaps, so to speak. So if you're planting warm season and cool season annuals, you end up with, a month here and a month there where there may not be anything available. So it's good for that. It also, deer love to eat it in most places. I see them, just annihilate that stuff. The problems that I see most common, you can talk about your experience as well, especially if it's different. We should point that out. But when I see people have problems getting it established and going for years and years, it's normally twofold. One is they're not taking care of it in terms of keeping weeds out of it. But once you get established really well, we're seeing this. I know you hadn't been out to one of our study sites recently, but I was yesterday. The white clover. We've got all these different things planted side by side, and the weeds are just horrible in several of them. And then you get to the white clover, and I mean, they're pretty clean. They're doing a pretty good job keeping the weeds
The
out
clover's so
themselves.
dense, it's shading out other
And the
things from
deer use is
germinating.
still heavy. All the other plants have wet, senesced months before now, so the deer aren't really hitting those other ones. So all those different things that the weeds aren't as prevalent there, but that normally is one problem that will limit you from keeping it going. And the other thing is drought during the summer, especially, like June, when it starts getting really dry, it's really hot, and this drought really seems to knock it back, particularly if you're not taking care of it. So if you have weed, if it's weedy and you have a bad drought 1 year, really hot, that's when I really see it just dries up and goes away. You lose it, and if you don't keep it going for 2 or 3 years, it's not really worth planting. It's pretty expensive up front, so you need to keep it going for a couple of years. So definitely take care of it. And it may mean more visits to the plot than you would typically have
Well,
with
that's
your annuals.
a real good point, Marcus. So one of our colleagues, Craig Harper, he actually did a little study on this, and he measured all of the inputs. If you remember that, I don't know, you may have been a part of that years ago, but
Well, I think he, I was tangentially part of it when I was working with him on as a student.
when you measure every trip you make, every time you run the tractor, all the herbicides, all the fertilizer, blah, 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 on and on and on, that planting a perennial with the thoughts that, hey, if I just plant this 1 year and I've got a food plot for the next 10 years, it's not so. And even from a cost perspective, heck, it's going to be a lot cheaper. I'm going to plant this one time. No, because you still have to come back with fertilizer. You still maybe at sometimes need to mow. You've still got to come back. The big deal is coming back and spraying, keeping those warm season grasses, warm season for
Especially if you're not in a area that retains some moisture, that you know, the combination of the droughty conditions with those those weeds are a big problem. So, and yeah, you may actually end up spending more money and more trips to that plot to keep it going. But it does serve some purposes. And some people have the ideal condition on their property to grow perennial clovers, and they don't have much weed problems. And, you know, in some cases, it may end up being even financially better.
Yeah. And so that's kind of my ideal on a landscape or a property. If I can do it like I want to do it, of all my food plot acreage, I want a third or a little more in cool season plots. I want a third or a little more in warm season plots. And notice I didn't say I want the same ones. I want that plot over there warm season. I want that plot over there cool season. And I want the plot over there, I want it to be perennial.
Yeah.
So that we have food on the landscape 24/7.
I think that's one mistake that a lot of people make, is they put their perennials and annuals together. That doesn't make much sense if you start thinking about it. So I agree with you completely. Now, there are a couple of different options where you may plant the same ground with annual warm season and cool season, and it can work pretty well together. But again, you know, like the examples we gave earlier in this podcast, that warm season plot starts looking really good when you're in the middle of November and you haven't had any rain in 2 months, and everything else failed. So you may not want to use that same ground for that, even in the couple of scenarios where you could make it work really well, like like overseeding wheat into you know, some of your warm season stuff. So
and you can get some more advanced strategies. We'll try to get this on our,
like a seed drill or something like that.
Yeah, I was gonna say you can drill in warm season sometimes within a cool season.
Yeah, or vice versa.
Or vice versa, and so you can have them both. But your typical food plotter that's either using a tractor with a disc or an ATV with a disc,
right? Hand seeder or something.
Yeah, they're not gonna be able to do that. But
yeah, best just to keep the ground separate if you can.
Yeah. All right, Marcus. Well, got anything to wrap up with, or think we've talked food plots enough?
Yeah, I think we've covered most of our bases.
Okay. And when we get deeper into the analysis on our deer selection study and all the minerals and that sort of stuff, we'll devote another episode a few months down the road.
Yeah, I'd love to come back to that once we have a better idea of that experiment. But I think a lot of the listeners would appreciate, you know, how good those results will be if we can show something.
And bottom line, our goal with this is we want to be able to help people plant the right plots for their property at the cheapest price.
Yep.
Yeah, help them save money, real effective food plots at the cheapest price. Well, I guess we'll wrap it up there, Marcus. And thank you all for tuning in. And we'll see you next time on Deer University. We're glad you joined us today and hope you learned something valuable about deer management. If you have questions about this podcast or a question about a topic we haven't discussed, please log on to msudeerlab.com, click on the Deer University tab, and send us your questions. We'll get to them as soon as possible. In closing, we want to thank our employers, the Mississippi State University Extension Service and the Forest and Wildlife Research Center. We also want to thank the St. John and Dudley Hutchinson families for their endowments that support deer research and education.